Hello and welcome to the Oxford Sidebar podcast for February 2012 from the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association. Our speaker for February was Professor Colin Blakemore, and he led a lively and informative discussion on the war on drugs and if we'll ever win it. We hope you enjoy.
He's Professor of Neuroscience at Oxford University, but while also maintaining an active research and teaching career, he's done many other things, most of them too many to notice, to make note of tonight, but including chief executive for the MRC. He's been the past president of the British Science Association, as well as president of the Association for British Science Writers, and also, how he manages to find time, he's also a commissioner for the UK Drug Policy Commission, and so tonight he's going to talk to us about the war on drugs and if we'll ever be able to win it. And thank you.
All right. Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the introduction. Now, the way that these things normally work, because I've done a few of them before, is that someone stands up, spiels for a while, no one really listens, and waiting for the interesting part, which is the questions. With this topic, I have absolutely no doubt that you need no introduction at all in order to have your own views on the subject, questions to each other more than me, I suspect. But let me just remind you of the background a little bit. It is 102 years since a group of world leaders met in Shanghai to discuss the problems of the opium trade, which you'll remember until a few years earlier, Britain had been intensively promoting in China and had carried out a fairly bloody conflict to support. And the result of that commission in Shanghai was the introduction of opium controls worldwide. 50 years ago or so, similar meetings, which were largely initiated by the United States, generated new protocols which were adopted internationally for the regulation of drugs, for the control and trafficking of illegal drugs. Now, just last year, the following letter, and some of you will have seen this, the following letter was published quite extensively, 50 years after the 1961 UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs was launched, the global war on drugs has failed and has had many unintended and devastating consequences worldwide, and so on. Use of major controlled drugs has risen. Supply is cheaper, purer, more available than ever before. The UN conservatively estimates there are now 250 million drug users worldwide. This is radical, rabble-rousing stuff, of course, signed by President Jimmy Carter, the former president of Brazil, the former president of Colombia, the former president of Mexico, the former president of Switzerland, of Poland, US Secretary of State George Shultz, and so on and so on. Suddenly, and it is, I think, relatively sudden, you can see the background to it if you really look, but there seems to have been a significant shift in attitude, at least in the ability to conceive that a change is needed. It's hard to get beyond thinking that to doing something about it for two reasons. One, when push comes to shove, politicians concerned about their electorates, about getting re-elected and so on, concerned in this country, especially about the Daily Mail, and that is not a joke. The Daily Mail has a huge influence on drug policy in this country, are actually scared to state publicly that they think that there is a need to address current approaches to the control of drugs, to admit that the war on drugs has failed, to admit that a different approach apart from warfare might actually be more productive. It's terribly difficult politically. The second obstacle is, of course, it's all very well to say that what we've done has failed, but it's hard to sustain that argument without an alternative. Without clear evidence of something that's better. And while the UN Convention has been operating, while it's had the pervasive influence that it's had, it's been very, very difficult to gather the evidence of other approaches, because there have been rather few. And we begin to see departures. I mean, the best known, longest standing is, of course, in the Netherlands, but now in Portugal, in Switzerland, in parts of the USA, some US states and South America, increasingly there are local regional experiments going on, new approaches to the problem, so we can draw on that evidence now of whether things get better or worse to guide, I think, what's really much needed, which is a proper comprehensive review of where we should go next on this problem. Let me just state where I come from in principle on the issue. I'd like to think I'm liberal-minded about most things, and I certainly think there are big problems with this issue, but in my lifetime, the change in the use of drugs and the influence of illegal drugs in society, I think, is one of the most insidious, pervasive and damaging things that's happened, frankly. That doesn't mean, and you'll see in the discussion, that I'm utterly opposed to the freedom for people to use substances of their choice to modify their state of mind, temperament or emotion or whatever. You are all doing it now. Most of you are doing it now. Not opposed to that in principle, but the damaging effect, especially of the crime surrounding the use of illegal drugs, I think has been hugely damaging in society. And the very fact that the substances which are most damaging are themselves illegal means that the approach to solving the problems that they create is constrained by the fact that we're dealing with what is classified in advance as a crime. And that's a really crucial issue. So I'm sure we'll get to things like harm reduction, medical problems versus criminal problems, supply, how you change the law, decriminalisation versus legalisation, and so on. But I'm not going to talk anymore. You, I'm sure, are bursting with your own theories, views, comments, and questions. So could I ask you to ask? I'll try and translate the question, so because it's recorded. And if you have comments, of course, yeah, say your piece, but try and keep it brief because we've only got an hour altogether. So, questions.
How is Portugal's experiment working out?
Yeah. The approach in Portugal has been pretty radical. Essentially decriminalisation. It's not full legalisation. Emphasis on harm reduction. So shooting galleries, supply of needles, so on, medical supervision of use. A blind eye to supply. And that is a really difficult issue which we ought to talk about. Same is true in Holland. The outcomes, in as far as it's possible to assess them at this stage, I think are in general pretty positive. Certainly no evidence of a massive increase in drug use. In fact, most of the data suggest a decrease. Certainly a decrease in the cost of medical problems and social problems generated by drug use. Decrease in crime level associated with drug use and supply. So, I think the signs in general are pretty good, but it really needs comprehensive analysis, I think, still, and probably longer to run before the experiment's really valuable in guiding others. In assessing these examples we now have, you always have to take into account the local setting. So, in a way, for instance, the longest history of a departure from US conventions is in the Netherlands, and I think everybody agrees that what might work in the Netherlands wouldn't necessarily work everywhere else. The experience in the Netherlands has been, in general, really very positive, and I can give you some facts and figures on that later. Yeah.
So one of the complicating issues in this is the distinction between drugs that are legal and illegal. And I'm just wondering what the science says about the potential danger of dabbling in some of the things that are currently illegal.
Yeah. The question was about illegal versus legal, and do we have evidence about the relative harms of legal social drugs like the one many of you are using? And there is growing evidence of exactly that comparison. I was involved in a well-known or notorious, depending on which political hat you wear, study published in The Lancet 3 years ago now, I think, with David Nutt, whose name I'm sure is familiar to all of you. Which was an attempt to devise an objective, well, not objective, I mean, an expert-based, evidence-based, comprehensive scale for the categorization of the harms produced by drugs. And I have to say, my major contribution to this study, which I think was important, was to press for the inclusion of social drugs as well as illegal ones in exactly the same mix. So that allowed us to produce for 20 substances, including 5 legal social drugs, to produce a scale, an ordnance scale, on which they were all compared with each other. And as I'm sure many of you know, alcohol came out very near the top of the list. And this was integrating all the measures of harm that we could think of, 9 different categories of harm, social harms, tendencies to addiction, harm to the user, and all these kinds of things. And alcohol was just behind street methadone. So it was the obvious culprits at the top, you know, heroin, cocaine. We didn't distinguish between powder cocaine and crack cocaine, but I think most people's judgments were tilted towards crack cocaine, which is an unbelievably horrible, dangerous substance. Street methadone, alcohol. Tobacco was a little bit further down because the short term, the acute impact on the user and on is rather low, and the impact on society is not hugely negative. There are problems with secondary smoking and all those kinds of things, but the real problem, of course, with tobacco is the long term damage and the cost to health service. So it came out well, certainly above cannabis, above ecstasy, above LSD, above amphetamines, and so on. So the two most commonly used social drugs in this country would have justified an A or B classification in the law. You know, 14 years in prison for supply, if they'd been illegal drugs. So, I think that sort of analysis is important because it obviously should lead you to question then what is the basis of saying something, substances will not be allowed, have this draconian stamp of illegality, censured by the Daily Mail, stamped on them, and others are, well, kind of fine. I'm waiting to hear what David Cameron says about minimal pricing of alcohol. We'll see. But it's a very important question, and that should be clearly in the frame if we do manage to think afresh about the problem.
And the science is robust?
The science is more robust. This is a very good point. I mean, the science is much more robust on the legal substances than it is on illegal, because they're recorded, your medical records. They're logged in as the causes of admission to hospital and this and all that sort of causes of death and everything. So it's all absolutely above board. We know an awful lot about alcohol use, methods of supply, costing, availability, you know, impact it has on societies in the law, because that's all documented, because they're legal. We know enormously less, really, about the impact of illegal substances.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, you can tell us.
You put tobacco ahead of above cannabis. Why was that, when most cannabis is smoked with tobacco?
Yeah, well, we tried to. The classification system we used was to get a whole bunch of experts, the members of the ACMD, for one thing, Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs, addiction section of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, I mean, a whole lot of social workers, police, and so on, all got them independently to rate all of these substances on these 9 categories. Then we brought them together for consensus conferencing, hammered out what were the origins of deviations from the average, and got consensus on a ranking for all 9, for all and so on. Ranking for cannabis was undoubted. We didn't say pure cannabis. We didn't say skunk versus resin or whatever. We just said cannabis. And I suspect most people were ranking on the basis of the fact that cannabis is used with tobacco. So that actually probably upped the scale of estimate of harm for cannabis. Sure. I mean, the evidence for harmful effects on the lungs of cannabis use, well, I'm sorry, suggest that the major evidence of harm comes from the fact that cannabis is smoked with tobacco. We really have rather little evidence. I'm not saying that it's positive. Rather little evidence of the impact of cannabis smoking alone on lung disease. Yeah.
Bearing that last question in mind, would it not be a very good thing for the government or some organisation to do to find some other more healthy medium in which to smoke the cannabis?
Yeah, so here's the back, why not find a healthier way of smoking cannabis? Well, you don't have to smoke it with tobacco, not that I'm speaking with any experience. You don't have to smoke it with...
No, but that's, yeah, the tobacco. But, you know, it does generate resins and things. I mean, there would be a concern. Fortunately, still, most cannabis users are not smoking 40 a day. So, you know, if it has similar kind of impact to smoking a regular cigarette on lung function, then a little bit proportionately lower because of the numbers that are smoked. Yeah, but better, healthier way of delivery might be. Yeah, oh, that's right, absolutely. Which is in the end much more dangerous.
Yeah, so let's find some lettuce or whatever it was, and dried lettuce or whatever it was, and
yeah.
Bake with it.
Without you know, disclosing identity, how many of you here who have used cannabis? Well, let me put it another way. On the basis of your experience of cannabis use, how many of you think that it would be, as it were, less attractive as a drug if some utterly harmless, kind of sterile approach, like a pill, let's say, coming out of a foil pack, was produced to supply it?
I think so.
You think it would be less attractive?
I think it's a very social, it's a social thing.
Yeah.
I certainly was with me a long time.
Well, there's got a confession here. We're going to tot up the confessions at the end of the evening. what do you think, though? I mean, do you think part of the business of drug use is the kind of aura, the mystique, the ritual, the procedures, the hardware and stuff that's...
It is when you're young, but as you get older, that becomes less important. If you can just take a pill and it's neat and go out and be a bit stoned as you were in the pub, that'd be very nice.
I wonder how many agree with that.
What do you think of the California law on cannabis? Because medical use is legal now, isn't it?
Yeah, and some of the discussion.
California, yeah. You just need the word stress and you get to
Your stuff. Yeah, a lot of the discussion in this country, including in the House of Lords, there's a group, nucleus of peers who are thinking about this issue, about the way to push it forward. And one of the possible approaches is to use the medical cannabis argument for both control, supply, and making it more available so as to generate, as it were, evidence on the effects of loosening up. I'm a little bit worried about the hypocrisy of that, actually. You know, if you say, well, of course it's only allowed medical use, but we'll allow excuses like, you know, my foot hurts a bit today, or whatever, you know, as a reason to be able to get it, then it sort of fudges the issue philosophically and politically.
Well,
that's another issue. That's of course there was an option on the last local elections in California to allow the taxation supply of cannabis to help solve California's budget problems. That wasn't passed, that is a very difficult issue, very difficult for politicians and the public to swallow. The notion that you suddenly transform something which is, you know, beyond consideration for society, I mean, utterly unacceptable, into something which is raising money for society, you know, to overcome problems of the banks or whatever. I mean, no, that's a very big step, and I find that ethically quite worrying myself.
They're managing the prostitution.
What, taxation?
Yeah. Charging for interest. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but would you say that then the incentives for raising money through drug sales might become kind of pervasive to the point where governments, politicians were actively encouraging people to smoke because it will raise more money?
Takes it away from drugs.
Yeah, but it's the drug dealers that are making the money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and because they're making the money, we're all very critical of them, especially politicians, and I can give you lots of evidence that the real evil in this process, the real evil in this process, sorry?
It's down to unemployment that people sell drugs.
Yeah, but let me just make a point. I think there'd be very general agreement the real villains, the evil in this process is supply. The huge amounts of money that are being made between the producer and sale on the street, the process of, you know, encouraging
drug use, the sort of drug wars and battles, the crime, the violence and so on, associated with supply. So great, let's just take over supply. But the problem is that if you criticise all of those things, it's very difficult to take over the supply without inheriting some of the reputation associated with supply. And suddenly transforming supply into something which is beyond the pale, into something which is perfectly acceptable and as a way of raising money, it's tricky. I mean, that's been fudged in Holland, where the front door of coffee shops is legal, just about decriminalised. The back door is not. So everyone has to turn a blind eye to the fact that this stuff is being bought by coffee shop owners, essentially illegally. It's an illegal trade. But they're then allowed to sell it once they've got it. And it's a fudge.
So you pointed out the research about, and this has previously been about the Class A, Class B, Class C drugs and so forth, mm-hmm. and how they are completely unscientific. I mean, drugs like or things like tobacco are rather more insidious or dangerous. I'm talking about a biological perspective. But then, I mean, we have to first decide what is it that we are afraid of. Like, are we afraid of ill health or health defects to people in society? If so, then we don't want to sell and make money off of these kind of stuff or legalize that kind of stuff. It just doesn't make any sense that you kind of arbitrarily say, if you sell this, then you become a drug dealer just because it's illegal today. But if you're already selling that, then you're not a drug dealer. I mean, it's kind of mixed up. So it doesn't make any sense at all.
Did you get the direction of the question? Very difficult to switch. And the point's partly been made already from you know, being a drug dealer to sanctioning drug use. And because the experiment's been tried and failed in the US with the attempt to criminalise alcohol supply, and it totally failed. In fact, alcohol, towards the end of the prohibition period, alcohol use was escalating very rapidly, and it drove a whole lot of new crime. So it's, you know, it's extremely difficult to move substances from being legal to being illegal, and equally, I think, difficult to move them from being illegal to being legal.
Do you think the police are winning the war against drugs?
Well, you should ask the police, and how do you measure it? I mean, there's no doubt that police activity, because of police activity, there is less drug use than there would be in the present context. I mean, if you suddenly stopped any policing of drug supply and use, I've little doubt that it would increase. I mean, because the dealers have got, you know, strong motives to try and sell more. So more would come into this country, they'd be distributed more widely and freely, and they'd be easily available. So I think drug use would increase. So to that extent, you could say that police activity is reducing drug use. But then the baseline for that measurement is so peculiar because it is the present state of the war on drugs. And if supply wasn't in the hands of criminals, then it conceivably drug use could be enormously reduced, even without policing being increased. Yep, the back. Well, there's been a lot of talk, of course, over the last 20 years about harm reduction, the emphasis on harm reduction. In fact, I mean, you know, dare I say it, that the initial shift in policy on that issue was in the Thatcher years, in the 80s. The evidence is that Mrs. Thatcher herself wasn't particularly happy about it, but there was a shift, and partly the evidence was economic, that there could be a saving to the NHS and so on. There are kind of ups and downs. I would say that policy hasn't been terribly well maintained, but I agree that if we could, it's a very important thing to separate the attitude of society to users and the social problems that are generated by drug use. Treat that as a social and medical problem, as opposed to the supply and the criminality that flows from the supply problem. They're still mixed up, and I'm afraid that the way that they're mixed up, you know, the kinds of penalties, for instance, that you face through drug possession and use vary enormously with where you live and what colour you are. So the police have these powers, and while they don't exercise them you know, uniformly, they clearly can use them when they want to for other reasons. If there are suspicions about an individual or, you know, maybe prejudice against a group, then there are laws for them to apply. It would be good to be more consistent in that. Yeah.
So if the US, in 10 years' time, if the liberal Democrat government was to turn around and have a radical change of mind about drugs policy, how would that affect UK, Europe, the rest of the world's drug policy? Is the fact that the US, at least on a federal level, is so against drugs, an issue for the rest of the world?
Yeah. Well, the question was, you know, isn't the US so fiercely opposed to drug use and any relaxation, you know, that it's going to be very difficult for other nations alone to produce any general change? Is that a fair summary? Yeah, I don't know what you feel, but I mean, if Obama gets re-elected, it's only going to be, you know, he has only one more term. I think he's going to have much more freedom to be the kind of politician that we all hoped he might be first time round. We might see some, you know, some pretty interesting policy debate in the US within the constraints of his majority in Congress, if he has one. And drugs will be on the agenda, that's for sure. I mean, there are signals from the states already that that's true, that thinking is at least evolving around the issue. And yeah, without the agreement of the US, it's hard to imagine that there would be comprehensive sign up for global change, which is much needed. But, you know, what about ideas for, I mean, let's have your ideas for how things could be changed, maybe stepwise. And some of you, I'm sure, would like to say, well, you know, people are entitled to do whatever they want to. Let's try and get it to supply the stuff so that we can get rid of the criminals if we can. Well, that's all the problem. But let's try and think of a stepwise change, something you might be able to sell to the electorate or to the US administration. Any ideas? Yeah, Mac.
So can you explain the difference between decriminalisation and legality? Because those are two different words that use a lot in this context. And it's always clear what people mean by the two. So perhaps those two concepts are better understood.
Okay. Well, I mean, in my understanding, decriminalisation... Well, legalisation would mean essentially kind of free-for-all with supply in the hands of the commercial sector, just like alcohol and tobacco. There might be some kind of regulatory process which would control the mechanism, supply, the pricing, who it can be made available to, the strength and all these kinds of things. But essentially it would just go into the capitalist free market. Decriminalisation leaves could leave the present structure virtually unaltered in terms of supply, illegality, and so what isn't allowed and allows on, but would limit the offences for which people could be prosecuted. So it could be a progressive change in which, for instance, users of drugs were no longer prosecuted at all. So they would no longer be considered as criminals. The criminal elements of the existing law and the prohibitions will be focused on supply. But as far as the user's concerned, it would no longer be essentially illegal. It would be decriminalised.
How would the policy make the dealers
that don't use. Okay, so a suggestion here that dealers should get life if there were decriminalisation. Why do you say that? Yeah, well, these personal stories, I think, are really, really important.
Yeah, and I feel that when people use drugs themselves and they use them because they just can't help it because they're addicted to it, they should be treated very, not as they are now, not as they're a druggie, and not be labelled, but be helped. Yeah. But people that deal...
That don't never use, but they do it just for money. I absolutely think I should get by. He used to be like that in the 50s and the 60s. So I had several friends who were around, but they got their prescriptions. No, we can't buy this rubbish. Well, we're talking about dealers at the moment, and what's the appropriate penalty for us.
Surely you have to make a discrimination between dealers who are going to give you a 20 quid bit on the street corner and somebody's bringing in 20 quid, 10, 20 tons in a yacht. They're both demons, but it can't be surely.
Yeah, but the 20 quid in a yacht eventually becomes 20 quid on the street. 20 tons on a yacht becomes 20 quid on the street corner, doesn't it? I mean, there's got to be a link between them.
Yes, I know. So why? You can't give them both the same penalty, surely. Yeah,
the one on the street is the one who's definitely caused them, you know, whereas the yacht person might
give away. Well, yeah. Although that's...
Well, no, but they're both...
The 20 quid, the 20 ton, there won't be the 20 quid on the street, will it? But you still don't get the guy in the 20 quid on the street, giving 30 years...
Well, what are you saying? I mean, where then should we draw the line?
I mean,
you're
saying that's
some dealers should be... Some dealing should be decriminalised? Are you suggesting
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Yep.
How many people would support that? Some dealing in drugs should be decriminalised.
The same as in Amsterdam, the guy in the coffee shop deals... doesn't get busted.
Yeah, and what about the person who buys for their friend here and hands out? I mean, legally that's dealing, even if they don't charge.
One of the
dealing.
Problems with the English law is that it's either yes or no. There's lots of places.
Well, no, that's not true. Actually, it's not true. When it gets in front of the judge, it's not true. It's yes or no. There's a lot of discretion on penalties. Unfortunately, sometimes it gets exercised on the basis of whether the judge likes the look of the individual.
Well,
that's
true, but in the law itself.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was a fun to bring that 50s model back, so if people were heroin addicts, they'd get pure stuff rather than...
Yeah, well, that has happened. I mean, that was happening in the 80s. Not all parts of the countries now have clean supply of clean needles and the opportunities to shoot up under medical supervision. I mean, methadone prescription is available everywhere. There are problems with that, like how it's delivered. It's supposed to be consumed on the spot because there's a secondary market in methadone users. So, you know, there's a problem. Did your daughter have experience with that, with methadone? Did she? I'd be very interested. You should take the microphone and tell a little bit about your story, because it might colour the discussion.
Sure?
What? Yeah, just say what happened to her. How she was treated. Yeah, exactly.
My daughter was at boarding school. She started smoking cannabis, which you all seem to think is quite fun, or some of you. She had a very bad reaction to it. She had psychosis.
Can you hear?
She didn't have schizophrenia, but she had very similar symptoms to schizophrenia. She slowly went downhill over many years, over 15 years. She got worse and worse. She had a lot of contact with the psychiatric services. She had a lot of mental health problems. She just slid further and further and further downhill. She took heroin at the end and crack cocaine. She went on methadone for a very small time. But she actually got off of that, surprisingly, with the help of her team. And we think she killed herself with heroin. But I don't actually know whether it was an overdose or whether she did it purposely. But I'm 99% sure she did it on purpose, because she took her plug out of the wall of her telephone, and she wrapped it up, and she had a pen and a notebook in her hand. So you can see why I have really strong views.
Can I ask how she was treated by medical services, NHS?
I found at times it very difficult, because we had to always go back through the GP to get to the Warnford. She sometimes was in a really bad state in the middle of the night or a bank holiday. She couldn't seem to get the help we needed. The police thought it was ridiculous. But when she got with the assertive outreach team for the last 2 years of her life, and they were making huge progress where her days were becoming days, and her nights were nights. She did some cookery courses. She was beginning to get more stable. But towards the end, just the week before she died, they were meant to be seeing her daily to give her a meds, and they hadn't seen her for 5 days.
What's your conclusion then? That's your anecdote. What is your conclusion?
What about what?
You take that strong opinion.
You
told us your story.
Okay.
Very sad.
Okay. So what? What's my conclusion about drugs, or what's my conclusion about
what's your opinion about drugs?
as I said, I honestly think that people that deal, that don't use, should have a very strong punishment. And if they knew that that punishment was going to be there, I think they'd think twice about selling it just for money.
Would you say it's okay then to deal if you're a user as well? So if you're dealing to fund your own habit?
I think it's more understandable. I don't think it's okay.
Yeah, but I believe if they legalise heroin, dealing would stop.
Yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't legalise it. I think it might be the right thing to do.
And it would stop,
it'd get the dealers off the street, wouldn't it?
It would stop making lots of money, not paying any taxes.
Let's discuss the legalisation thing. Imagine that the government just said, OK, let's get rid of all this dealing, this dreadful traffic. We'll just take over... Let me get my point. We'll take over supply. We don't like the idea, but we see that it's much better than the profits and the crime and all this stuff. We'll supply clinical-grade... heroin, we'll supply cannabis. Cannabis is being grown for medical purposes in this country, so we'll supply all these things. They'll be quality controlled, we'll set the prices and so on. They'll be done under medical supervision. You have to sign up as a user. Let me make the point. If they did all that, and I think some of you might support that, how would you deal with potential new users? Would you allow them to sign up as well? Anybody could.
This country's got, it's about choice. Whether they're legal or not, people are still going to take drugs.
Yeah, you're not answering my question. How would you do? Say we'd got to this situation where the government took over supply, had registered users for all illegal drugs, supplied to them. Would you allow others to join the party?
If they managed it, it would stop a lot of deaths also.
Age of consent. What's wrong with that going with...
So anybody could sign up to take...
No, if you've got somebody that's used for 10, 15 years, right, that person has obviously got a CV to be managed. If somebody comes off the street 18 years old and says, right, I want free heroin for the rest of my life, surely there must be a boundary where you can say no.
Well, there's a civil rights issue there then, isn't there? So current users are okay, they can be supplied by the government, medically cared for and cleaned, yeah, and all these things, but no one else can join in the fund.
The government knows the difference between somebody that's been using 25 years and somebody that's been using 2 years.
What do other people think about that?
Well, again, you could have a problem, because you're saying, as this guy says, if you already have somebody's established drug addict, you do that, you can get them off it. But then if the government is in control of all the heroin, then there won't be any new addicts, but that obviously means there will be somebody will also be bringing it in illegally, because they know there'll be somebody underneath it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not being brought in illegally, it's being managed.
Well, but none of it's not being made available legally to others who want it.
It's already been studied in countries like, I'm not quite sure, it's Amsterdam or where they go into, I'm not sure what country it is, I've just said that, but they go into like a place where the nurse gives it to them, they can have as much as they want, and then they gather around.
Portugal.
They go gather around an area, and they're free to do as pleased as they want.
And this is available to any new user.
I'm not saying that's the right way about it. My argument is.
Yeah, but okay. So
if it's legal or not, people will choose to take drugs.
Yeah, but you see the point. I mean, there's a problem. If you make the supply legally controlled, then how do you prevent a black market developing around it unless it is freely available to new users? So, and how then do you regulate the new users?
That's not my job to sort out. It's the government's job to sort out.
that's a cop-out. Yeah.
Do you think you need to alter policy just on the drugs that are sort of below the line in your scale of the modern legal ones, or does it have to be all or nothing if you're going to get rid of these kind of social problems that come with the illegality of the trade?
That's a good question. Do it all in a stroke or work upwards, as it were. And I think, yeah, by default we're going to have to work upwards, because last year there were more than 50 new mind-altering drugs that were legal, because they're not yet presently classified, made available
mainly through internet dealing. So legal highs is a huge issue. You know, there are clever chemists beavering away in backroom labs in China, tweaking a molecule here and an atom here and there on a structure, knowing it'll affect a receptor in the brain, have the same effect as whatever, amphetamines or heroin or whatever. So we're going to have to deal with that. So I suspect that a change in approach to those new substances will actually drive a reconsideration of the drugs that lie at the bottom of the scale of classification. Difficulty with that is that the scale of classification is wrong. So it's pretty clear to me that ecstasy and particularly LSD should not be Class A drugs. They should be Class C on all criteria for harm. So if you start tackling the present structure of classification of drugs, saying, oh, we'll look at the low harm ones first, you get it wrong because the classification's wrong. I mean, we showed in the paper in The Lancet that statistically there is no significant correlation between the current classification and the actual harm of drugs. And yet that's what the classification's all about.
Tack on to what we have been discussing so far. I mean, we have been discussing recreational drugs, but I know that about a year and a half ago, many Oxford scientists participated in a Nature discussion, which was not about recreational drugs, but about prescription drugs and things like modafinil and Ritalin, which are called nootropics or brain stimulants or smart drugs. So people here have been speaking about personal choice, freedom of choice, and legal age of consent. I mean, what about those things? I mean, things that you're pointing out. Because of countries like Czech Republic and other countries, I'm not picking on Czech Republic. If you have a prescription from a medic in Czech Republic, which you can buy off the internet for about £7, you can then legally get drugs, these kind of prescription drugs in this country.
Yeah. And let's not forget that many street drugs are also prescription drugs are available on prescription. So there's a huge overlap at the level of chemistry. And it's very hard then to impose a sharp distinction on the basis of the way in which drugs are being used. But yeah, I think this is a very good point. The whole lot of other socially active drugs, cognitive enhancing drugs, or whatever. That are going to be raising the same question of where should governments and how should governments intervene in the liberty or otherwise of individuals to choose what substances to put inside themselves. Yeah.
So I think how has public opinion changed over the last few years? You know, the stuff like paper in The Lancet, how has the evidence-based influence public opinion on drugs policy?
Yes, there are surveys of public opinion. There's no doubt there's a shift towards at least being willing to consider changes in legal attitude to drugs. Let's not forget that when David Blunkett asked the ACMD to review cannabis and clearly asked them on the basis of an expectation that they would suggest a downgrading in cannabis, that was driven largely by the growing concern of parents, and especially, frankly, middle-class parents, that their kids, whom they knew were using, 60% of kids at that stage, 60% probably had used cannabis during the school years, could get a criminal sentence, could get a criminal record if this was discovered, and most middle-class parents expected their kids would go through this phase and come out of it, stop using it, go on, have perfectly normal lives. They didn't want their kids to be labelled as with a criminal record. So there was a lot of social pressure, I think, at that stage for a modification in the attitude of the law to the use of cannabis particularly. So, I think there is a gradual shift and a gradual recognition that what we've been doing over the last 50 years has not worked.
That's the public. What about the politicians? As you said earlier tonight, as soon as it comes push and shove, they back off. They went from C back to B. They've done it time and again. Even if their own children have been users themselves.
Or they themselves have used.
I didn't inhale.
Yeah. Well, that's a problem. That comes back to the first point that I made. The political problem, whatever the real opinion.
That's a big
of our politicians. When push comes to shove, will they be prepared to do it because of the reputation that they might gain through being associated with it? Nicotine, well, milligram for milligram, nicotine. But, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's how much you take. But it is important to distinguish between addictive and non-addictive drugs. And in general, your cannabis particularly, ecstasy, are not classically addictive. And they don't drive the modification of neuronal circuitry that characterizes addiction. They can produce cravings. They can produce, you know, habitual use and dependency. But it's the opiates, heroin, particularly cocaine, nicotine, which are the really powerful addictive drugs. I'm ever so sorry. In compensation, you have my microphone. There you are. So you can have it.
Where do I hold it?
Okay, hold it close to you.
Can anyone hear?
Yes.
I've got a very good friend whose son is a drug addict. He started dealing at school. And it was cannabis, then it was crack, and he has been addicted to ketamine for a very long time. He's now taking heroin. Now, the problem that I'd like you to discuss or whatever is that he has never, ever seen a medical professional. He gets to the state when he's completely wiped out, and then he'll go home. He lives like on the streets. He doesn't wash, he doesn't go home, he stinks. When he goes home, he'll sleep for 24 hours and he'll tell his mum, I'm never going to do this again, ever, ever, ever. And then he goes off, he does it again, and she's tried, she's divorced, she's rung his father, they've tried intervention. He's said, oh yes, I'll come to the... But he won't, he runs away. They've tried going to getting his friends on board, and two of his friends have died within the last year, and she's really scared because it's heroin now. And but you know, he's so contrite. But the minute the horrible feeling wears off, he's back again, and they cannot get him to go. And you, at that age, he's now 28. You can't make them go to the doctor, and I just wonder what your opinion of that is.
Well, I'm not sure I have an opinion which is worth any more than anybody else's opinion on that. I mean, this kind of personal tragedy has to, well, you know, it's easy to sit back, read The Guardian and think, you know, great, you know, well, actually, it's ridiculous to control people's freedom. But you have to colour your view of what's reasonable by these personal stories, by personal experience, by the damage which is done to individuals. Anything which might make it easier to suffer in the way that this boy has.
They be, you know, mental, whatever you call it.
Sectioned. What about that? Yeah, medical?
He has to be doing something for that to happen. Mm. It becomes a social nuisance or become something to be sectioned.
Yeah, but you can't actually force people to go to a doctor. I mean, you put them in prison, and a lot of the penal system is focused on drug use, frankly. I mean, the level of drug use in prisons is astounding. And higher when people come out of prison than before they go in. I mean, that's another worry as well. But, you know, you can't force people to take medical care. That's a problem.
But how do you get them without, you know, help them without sectioning? There's nothing else, is there? They can't do intervention.
Yeah.
What else is there?
Yeah, and sectioning wouldn't get them to go to the doctor, you know, really necessarily. I mean, unless you're really suggesting locking them up.
That's when they legalise it, you might be able to get up and get a job.
What about personal responsibility, just your own, like, taking more responsibility for your own actions? And if it was to clear the information rather than the fear mongering that the government and the police force and the media gives out about drugs, if it was clear the evidence was given, and then people were allowed to make their own choices. And if you did decide to get yourself hooked, because no one's putting a needle in your arm, no one's forcing you to do anything. At what point can you not just say, this was your choice?
That's right. I mean, what, yeah. Exactly, that's the whole problem. You see, choice is the whole question of free will and choice is modified by the drug process.
And a lot of addicts I know come from privileged backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wanted to ask a question about the motivation behind governments to criminalize this in the first place, is because, as we've heard tonight, it leads to great tragedy in people's lives even before it was made illegal. There was a reason why people decided to criminalize opium. So I'm just wondering how does a government really, you know, you want to have laws that protect people, the reason we wear a seatbelt. But so how do you really reconcile these things? If we think that legalization will lead to a lessening of harm, but how do you really morally like deal with that issue, especially in terms of, you know, people do talk about cannabis as, you know, not so harmful, but how much of that is associated with the fact it's not accessible, like cigarettes are? And the, you know, there's a clear research link between cannabis use and schizophrenia. So how can a government really sanction that? So, I mean, there was a motivation behind criminalization to begin with, and so how do we reconcile that now?
Yeah, I mean, we should go offline on the question of the relationship.
Grown up and say that anything that he's found also has damage to it. Yeah. Alcohol, cream cakes,
answer the question.
Biscuits.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Nothing is.
Yeah, we should go offline. I think on the question of the extent of the relationship, the established relationship between cannabis use and schizophrenia. This is Robbie Murray's work, and you should read the ACMD. Report, a very extensive report on harms associated with cannabis. When they recommended that it should remain as C, and the government decided to ignore the recommendation of their own council. The evidence is that it could have a small impact on the total incidence of schizophrenia. But if you actually look at the evidence of prevalence of schizophrenia, it has decreased progressively over the past 50 years, while the use of cannabis has increased from virtually zero 50 years ago to, you know, 30% of the population said they've tried it. So it's hard to reconcile those two things. So whether it's causal is difficult to establish. But yeah, I mean, governments sanction all kinds of things that have risk associated with them. Driving to work, riding a bicycle, you know, drinking beer or smoking cigarettes, or everything that we do has some risks associated with it, and the government accepts that is just part of life. Whether politicians are willing to accept that using a chemical substance so as to change your mood or your state of mind that has established risks connected with it could be acceptable is, you know, difficult. You see the difficulty.
People are dying from drugs, day in, day out. Day in, day out.
Yeah, what's the point?
Well, you just seem so relaxed, you haven't got an answer for anything. You seem so laid back.
No, I mean, I'm not laid back. I don't have answers, but it doesn't mean I'm laid back.
You've probably never touched a spliff in your life.
He's not a god, he's just an ordinary.
He's a commissioner.
Now, I'm not giving you the answers, I'm coming here to ask whether you have them.
People die from driving cars, you better stop it.
No.
Well, you've obviously never had people in your family that have died from heroin overdose. You started off in life as a very pure, innocent.
So, what now? Okay, so let's have your view of what should be done.
You have these very strong opinions.
My beliefs are, right, I was 16 years old, right? I was a good kid. I didn't touch drugs until I was 18 years old. I started off with cannabis, right, and it led on to next thing. 20 flaming years of abuse to me and my family. I've got 3 addicts in my family, and nothing's being done about it.
Well,
why are you laughing, mate?
Yeah, but what would you? Okay, so what would you do?
Do you think that singer that just died at the weekend, do you think she wanted to end up like that? People need help, and they're not getting it. Simple as. It's all right talking about it and having discussions. Nobody's getting any effing help. It's all right laughing about it.
I'm not laughing.
Most of it, 90% of it starts from cannabis. Because people, I believe, they're not doing anything wrong.
Nobody starts out at 15 and they take their first step thinking, I want to become a heroine.
No, of course.
Start standing up for yourself, people. Come on, man.
So what are you actually... I'm not quite sure what you're advocating.
I read in the Oxford Mail last week, there was a discussion of war against decriminalising drugs. Right, you are the commissioner for this country.
No, I'm sorry, no, you're wrong. I'm a member
you're
of.
The, you're the top guy for this country.
No, you tell us
what. That's what it said in the Oxford Mail.
I mean, we're all equal in this issue. You tell us what you think could actually have been done to prevent the problems that you're describing.
But what is the point of this night? Where's it going to go? What's the next step? What's the point of us all here? No. Having a little chat, if I ain't going to solve anything.
Well, you know, lots of chats around the country. Eventually becomes democracy. When I started talking, one of the problems with thinking out of the box about this issue is that politicians are concerned about their reputation. And that means with the voters. So if the attitude of the public could gradually change to the point where they're saying to their politicians, we think something different has to be done, then maybe... the views of politicians will change. Yeah. Okay, so what, on the basis of your experience, what could have helped you and your family to stop getting into the mess that you've described?
I haven't got a clue.
Well, there you are.
From what I'm getting in this room tonight, a lot of people don't even know what heroin is. Right? And it all starts from cannabis. Right. I'm seeing a lot of helper faces in this room tonight. So, and I believe, okay, you can all discriminate me when I've gone, but I believe that heroin should be legalised.
I asked how you think the problem will be solved, and you've made a specific proposal. How could that have helped you?
Because I know a lot of people, right, that if they had the choice to get it every day, I've seen evidence that when people can get free prescription drugs, they can go to work every day, they can live a normal life. Whether if it's legal or not, they're still going to take it. That is your problem. That is this country's problem. And it seems like more and more drugs are coming into the country. Nothing's being done about that. We're over Afghanistan, supposed to be destroying all the opium. Nothing's being done about that. So what is the point of this gathering? That is my point. Are you going to go back and see somebody next week and go, I've got some really interesting stuff in that room?
Well, it would be nice to take back some...
Are you going to go and see somebody?
Nice to take back some clear ideas about what could be done.
What would you like to see being done? I mean, I bet you've never smoked a spliff in your life, have you?
I wouldn't...
Obviously not.
What would I like to see done? Well, first of all, I mean, sensible discussion about the issue, both in public and in Parliament, right, to get through the kind of smoke screen of silence that surrounds this issue. I think that would help. Recognition of some basic facts, like the fact that the present classification of the harms of drugs is a complete mess. the realization that a whole range of new drugs which are equally effective and damaging as those already exist are going to come onto the market soon. We have to be able to deal with those. The fact that supply is the real damage in this process, that users should be treated as victims rather than criminals. I mean, that's my kind of position. And I think there's a place for decriminalization, but I recognize the problem that produces of the backdoor front door approach to drug use. So I'm not going to put, you know, I don't have the answers. I wouldn't be here if I had the answers.
I just get angry because I feel nothing's being done about it.
No.
If it is legalised, the one thing is, as this guy says, actually, the heroin won't kill you. If you know exactly what you've got, if it's clean and you know the amount that you've got, you can carry. I have a friend who worked for 30 years as an electrical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what killed him. It was the shit that he got from a bad deal that killed him in the end. So if they knew exactly what they were having, they could function very well. This has been done in Switzerland, that's what
Switzerland
is all about. There were teachers and everybody. It's the fact that the drugs are unknown. That, I mean, here in Oxford, about 10 years ago, six, eight people died over Christmas because of a bad batch that came in.
Yeah. The one of the founders of the medical school at Oxford, Sir William Osler, a great doyen of medicine, his wife became a morphine addict because she was treated with morphine for a pain problem, and he injected his wife on a daily basis. They lived to a ripe old age, they, you know, were stalwarts of North Oxford society. So yes, it is possible.
It's just quick.
Yep.
Prison costs about four times more than rehab. And yet there's loads and loads of people in prisons that are heroin addicts that really should be in rehabs. But because the government want to show that people that are coming out of rehabs are being successful, it's really hard to get in a rehab. You have to really fight and stay on methadone for months and months and reduce it and reduce it and reduce it. And then eventually when they get into rehab, if it doesn't look good, if the numbers don't look good at staying off of it, they won't let them go in. And it just seems ridiculous that they could put four people in a rehab for one person in prison.
Do you know why they don't want to legalise it? Because it put a lot of people out of work.
One problem with rehab and the rehabilitation which goes on in prison, because you know some prisons spend a lot of their time trying to rehabilitate, is that it doesn't often work. You know, the best that's achieved frequently is that there's a decrease in drug dependence and use while in the program, but as soon as people get out on the streets again, you know, the relapse rate is extremely high, and they get back in the social context of drug use. I mean, this is one of the well-established, scientifically established facts, is that the environment in which drugs are used, the people you take it with, the paraphernalia that you use are very strong inducers of drug use. And you can't get rid of that with rehab.
What
are
the different drug users?
For example, heroin users, different kind of psychological therapies.
Well, you can't treat all drug users as the same, as it were, the same problem. They're very different categories of use. Yeah.
Why is it that methadone is preferred in treatment over heroin? Why not?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. Even better, you know, heroin and codeine. Codeine is a prescription drug, very effective painkiller. It's an opiate. A standard tool in the armory of respectable medicine to help people who've got pain problems. Heroin, street drug, you know, beyond the pale. They're both converted into morphine in the brain. And that's how they act. They're identical in their actions on the brain. They're converted into the same molecule, but one's an acceptable, socially acceptable, wonderful, miracle cure drug, and the other is, you know, utterly unacceptable. Well, methadone, the principal values, as it were, from the point of view of legal, social perspective of methadone heroin, methadone's more easily taken orally, and it has less, you can't overdose so easily with methadone as you can with heroin, so it doesn't produce death.
It's not only that, it is the
pharmacology and the way that it acts. There's a bigger gap between the effective dose and the lethal dose than there is for heroin. Yeah, but it is, I mean, it is hypocrisy, really, isn't it? When, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
If you were to legalize the sale of drugs, it seems as though you could have two models. You could have a free market model where you essentially have corporations like, you know, the cigarette companies who, you know, come and compete for the market, or you could have government that regulates it and you actually go to the government clinic and presumably purchase your known amount. Could you just comment on those two systems and how other countries with legalized drugs deal with that and which one they choose and how it works out?
No one's gone, as far as I know, no one's gone the full route of opening up drug supply to the commercial market. I mean, clearly that is in the minds of some companies. I mean, Philip Morris has experimental cannabis growing farms in North Carolina, I think. You know, so there, you know, there's interest. Yeah, and there's an interest in supply in this country. Certainly, legal cannabis production for medicinal use, multiple sclerosis particularly, is going on. So there, you know, there's kind of interest in the fringes around that. Rather than my opinion, let's have the opinion of others. What do you feel about the if we were to go to the step of allowing supply, do you think it should be strictly in the hands of government, maybe the Department of Health or whatever? You have to go to your GP to get your spliff? Or should it be, you know, marketed with all the problem, for instance, you know, tobacco sales and things, people making huge profits out of peddling things that they know to be lethal? I mean, is that right? You happy with that?
Well, to me, there seems like there's an implication there of personal responsibility versus not. So if you open it up to the free market and you say, okay, well, if companies can come in and regulate it, but now it's your problem because you made that choice to go purchase it from the company. And I think that the consequence would be that people that experienced health problems or psychological problems would be viewed basically the way they are now. Versus if the government stepped in, I might imagine that it's more considered a condition that we regulate and we treat, and the health falls within the health category, and so I think that it might be looked at more sympathetically. I don't know, that's just sort of my...
Yeah, view. I mean, one thing that would be very difficult to stop if it was just put in the hands of commercial organisations is advertising.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't... This is capitalism. You can't... Mm-hmm. You know, people are allowed to sell things, they're allowed to say that they're selling them and encourage customers. And how would we feel about that?
But there are large corporations.
Free advertising.
There are large corporations in California that are opening up clinics every single week. Mm. Cannabis corporations. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing about... there's an interesting approach which is being taken, and actually it has been suggested by the UK Drug Policy Commission, which I'm a member of, for the question of the legal highs. I mean, how to tackle this flood of new molecules. And one kind of interim approach, before you really start saying, well, you know, is this dangerous enough, should it be made illegal, is to put the onus of responsibility on to the back of the supplier. Say, okay, you know, you've got to be confident that what you're selling to people through the internet or whatever is safe, and there will be huge legal sanctions through civil action against you if there's evidence you're harming people by doing this. So you open up the whole legal process to allow users who feel that they've been damaged by something they bought over the internet to prosecute their claim directly to the supplier, which I think is an interesting approach. Put the responsibility for regulation, for claims of safety, on the back of the suppliers.
But is it not the case that this whole industry of legal highs exists only because they're illegal highs?
Most of it, yeah. I mean, there have been stages where there have been molecular breakthroughs. Ecstasy was one of them, LSD earlier than that, where entirely new categories of molecules with completely different psychotropic effects have been discovered. But I agree that the present market is largely just producing look-alike molecules for amphetamines or for ecstasy particularly. Yeah.
Oh, can I just pick up on your point about putting your onus on the supply? Because I was just thinking, actually, I'd like to ask, do you think it would be more helpful and more productive to consider the tackle the problem of drugs and their harm on society as an industry rather than as a rather than as a problem as, or as a use issue. It's more like an industry issue than sort of mentioned. You know, it's the large quantities coming in. Like that seems to be where if you could attack it at that point.
Yeah, but then how?
Large scale, that maybe not even attack it. That's the thing. They're lying the incentive so it doesn't happen.
But how do you turn that into a law? I mean, did you hear the question? Mm-hmm. You know, focusing on the issue.
Policy issue rather than a legal issue.
Mm.
How can we stop it happening on the bigger picture?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you see why in Switzerland 15 years ago, in Holland still now, Portugal lesser, in California. You know, the use to some extent has been decriminalized, but that still leaves a paradox of how you deal with supply. And no country has managed to go the whole hog and say it is a free for all. We'll just develop new laws to make sure that what is being supplied is as safe, as pure, as harmless as it can be. No one's really devised an approach to that yet.
Has there ever been a society, ever, anywhere in the world that doesn't have some kind of stimulant? Because as far as I understand it, there isn't any. Everywhere you go, from the jungles to the mountains, there's always something that somebody will take from a plant or something and sniff, inject, smoke.
Yeah, well, I know what you mean. I mean, I spend a fair amount of time in Abu Dhabi, and I think they're pretty close, frankly. Orange juice seems to be as far as most...
No, they have kiff and everything else.
I'm just wondering if there are campaigns for school children and students in further education where people like you who've had this terrible experience go around and talk about it to warn people not to start.
Yeah. Do you do that at all? I mean, have you spoken?
I don't. But ex-addicts do it.
So there are a number of organisations that do offer advice and counselling of that sort, and as you say, largely in the hands of former addicts. And I suppose there's no experience which is more convincing than that of someone who can recount their own difficulties and the ways out of the problem. A lot of the discussion around the whole issue of decriminalisation and so on seems to ignore the fact that young people are so especially vulnerable. And in some ways that's silly because there are all kinds of other things that we do, like drinking, smoking, getting married, voting, and so on. You're not allowed to do it because it's so dangerous until a certain age. So I think it is important to separate the attitude of society towards the use of these sorts of substances in young people and those who are judged to be able to make their own minds up. And the Netherlands has done that pretty well because although they've loosened up hugely on cannabis use for adults, they're really very strict about cannabis availability in schools. And as evidence of that, cannabis use by young people, underage people in Holland, which is illegal, is much lower than in this country, where it's so illegal. Actually, cannabis use by adults in Holland, where it's legal, is lower than cannabis use in this country. It's illegal, but not very much. I think you've done a very good job. And there's an important point here that a lot depends on education and explaining why something that might be available to do when you reach the age of 18 is actually not allowed before the age of 18. And there are lots of things like that that we accept. It's much easier to approach that kind of discussion with a young person if you're not talking about something which is going to be a crime after the age of 18. I mean, voting isn't a crime, but it's not allowed for young people. So it's much easier to explain that than saying, there are these things which are always a crime, whatever your age, but you especially should be concerned about not exposing yourself. Okay, a third of people have smoked cannabis or do, but you're young and you definitely shouldn't do it. I think the whole approach to education would be different and easier
against the context of decriminalisation for adults. Others would agree with that. What are we doing? Oh, yeah.
Please give you a break. Thank you for a wonderful talk, and also the audience. I've had an amazing I'm sure that Helen wouldn't mind continuing the discussion a bit more. I'll get you a
legal drug.
A legal drug, and you can just have a bit of rest. And you're all welcome to stick around and continue the discussion. Thank you for coming.
I'm joined by Professor Colin Blakemore of Oxford University, Professor of Neuroscience, and also Commissioner for the UK Drugs Policy Commission.
That's correct.
What does the Drugs Policy Commission do?
They're an independent charity, and they look at the policy with respect to illegal drugs, and make comments on the basis of evidence about current policy. And increasingly have been making suggestions and recommendations about the changes in policy.
So I guess one of the key questions is do the government listen?
I think they do. I mean, it depends how far we go, as it were, but I think the government's been very responsive, the Department of Health particularly, in our comments on harm reduction, on treatment of particularly of opiate addicts, on stigma, on the problems associated with stigmatizing drug users and their difficulty of getting back into work and contributing to society because of stigma. So in many areas where I think the Commission's had a huge influence.
What other sorts of things do you look into? So obviously there's the actual science of harm from drugs themselves, but do you also look at the sort of wider scope of the social and maybe economic evidence behind drug policy as well?
Yes, the government has called for comments on its drug policy in the last 6 months, and the UK Drug Policy Commission and other organisations have provided a lot of input to that process. We also deal with a number of committees within Parliament, select committees, all-party parliamentary groups, and so on, that feed into the democratic process in discussing drug policy. I mean, it has to be said that this is an extremely sensitive and difficult area, and we have to recognise the problems that politicians face in thinking about new approaches to drug policy. And I think they're of two sorts. One, the perception that politicians almost inevitably have about the negative reactions from the media and from their own constituents about any suggestion of relaxation in drug law. And the second is that even if the politicians should reach the stage where they recognise that current laws are not working well, the war on drugs is not working, the problem is, what do you put up as an alternative? You know, it's not reasonable to sweep away an existing policy, even if it's not terribly successful, if you don't have anything that's going to be better. So I think we need to do a lot of work on thinking about viable alternatives which are likely to work.
So you've obviously looked at a number of countries' sort of approach to drug policy as well. So which country do you think has had the best approach to drugs policy that's worked for them? I mean, I'm sure that not everything that works for one person is going to work for another country. So in terms of sort of drug harm reduction, which country do you think is doing the best and why?
Well, I mean, at first I should say that I agree completely with you that it's not easy to draw conclusions or evidence from the various experiments that have been done around the world because of the social context. I mean, what might work well or not work well for Holland won't necessarily work for everyone else. So you have to look at it in the social context. But the obvious examples of new approaches to drug use are in the Netherlands, which has the longest experience here, in Portugal in the last three years or so, with the very radical changes in decriminalisation, also in South America, and in parts of the United States as well, interestingly. I mean, the general impression that I have, and I should say I'm not in this respect speaking on behalf of the UK Drug Policy Commission, but I mean, the general impression I have is that None of those experiments has been disastrous in the sense that none of them has produced an enormous increase in drug use, and many of them have seen a decrease in drug use. I mean, the difficulty here, and that is that the facts and figures are not well documented. And one thing we desperately need is more evidence. Evidence about what really happens, what is currently going on, and then evidence about the consequences of any changes in the law. I mean, in order to think about a better policy than the one that we have globally, we really need firm evidence on which to base that. Well, the longest-standing experiment, as it were, is in the Netherlands, which essentially decriminalised cannabis use, specifically cannabis use, 20 years ago. That involved some degree of legal and political hypocrisy, in my opinion, because while the supply of cannabis through the coffee shop system is no longer criminal, the obtaining of cannabis by coffee shop proprietors is still illegal. So there's what's called the front door, back door problem, which needs to be faced, I think, by any government that's thinking about changes in policy. The difference between use and supply. But in Holland, the general impression, I think, is pretty positive. And certainly the statistics for cannabis use in Holland show that it's certainly not the highest in Europe. It's lower than in the United Kingdom. It's lower than in the USA. It's much lower than Australia. And perhaps more significantly, the use of hard drugs, of crack cocaine, of heroin and so on, is really quite impressively low in Holland compared with the rest of Europe. And amongst the lowest European country particularly for mortality associated with drug use, especially heroin. So I think, you know, we should look at that experiment seriously, recognising that what might work for Holland won't necessarily work everywhere else, but look seriously at the evidence. I mean, more radically, other than the changes in Portugal recently, and also, you know, in South America, there are some countries which are moving in the same direction. Portugal seems to have adopted a comprehensive decriminalisation of drug use, even including heroin and cocaine. So focusing the law on the issue of supply and allowing the use of drugs, providing clean facilities and medically regulated facilities, for instance, for heroin use, not prosecuting users. And in the short time that experiment has been running, again, the results are not discouraging. This is all valuable information, I think, which should guide. I think this is a really important point. What we need is a comprehensive review, and that means global. It means the United Nations, especially. It means the United States to be on board for recognising that we need a new approach.
So, in order to maybe get away from the drugs policy side, where the politicians are a bit concerned about their constituencies' reactions to taking perhaps a more evidence-based approach to drugs, do you think maybe we need some more a mechanism or maybe more sort of public debate on the actual evidence base of this in order to try and help achieve a more fair drugs policy within the UK?
Yeah, well, I think public opinion is incredibly important. Because a lot of the fear that politicians have about even discussing the issue is based on the assumption that their constituents are very hostile to any change. So we do need to open up the discussion, but of course you can't have a useful discussion without evidence, without facts and figures, and frankly there's not a lot of that. And also the way in which the public get their information about all kinds of issues is usually through the media, and the media are, you know, in many respects as biased and prejudiced as politicians are on this issue. So, I'm a little bit pessimistic, really, about the quality of public engagement on this issue. I mean, it is really crucially important to have that open public discussion. And interestingly, there was a period where public opinion, I think, had some influence on government thinking, which didn't last very long or go very well, and that was in over the issue of the classification of cannabis. I think that
it is widely acknowledged that David Blunkett's willingness to downgrade the classification of cannabis was at least partly based on the feeling that parents of teenage children, perhaps especially middle-class parents, were very concerned about their kids getting a criminal record for occasional use of cannabis when their expectation was that they would, as it were, grow out of it and it wouldn't be a major problem in the future. So there was a recognition in the public that children, that young children were using cannabis, but the feeling that they'd get over it and get away from it, and the fear that they might get a criminal record if they were discovered. And that drove, I think, the government's thinking about it, reclassification of cannabis. So, you know, public opinion can have an influence. More important, I think, is the attitude of the media, maybe especially the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail has a large readership. The Daily Mail has been consistently incredibly hostile to any discussion about relaxation, as they would say, on the rules about drug use. We have to get around that. We have to educate the press as well as the public.
Professor Colin Blakemore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found at our website, www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @OxfordSidebar and on Facebook, British Science Association, Oxfordshire Branch.